steps. "I can see but one reason," he wrote, "that I am too earnest, too anti-slavery, and, say, too radical to make him willing to have me connected with the administration, just as my opinion that he is not earnest enough, not anti-slavery enough, not radical enough, but goes naturally with those hostile to me." As his melancholy deepened, he generated another explanation that displayed the obtuseness that had always proved his undoing as a politician. "The root of the matter," he told his friend Whitelaw Reed, "was a difficulty of temperament. The truth is that I have never been able to make a joke out of this war." To Kate, who remained at the Sprague mansion in Narragansett through the summer, he confessed that he was oppressed by anxiety. "You know how much I have endured, rather than run counter to those friends who have insisted that I should remain in my place." He should have resigned earlier, he told her, right after Frank Blair's attack. Then he might have departed while heroically defending the radicals against the conservatives. But now, "I am reproached with having left my post in the hour of danger. And though the crushing load is off my shoulders, there is the regret that I cannot finish what I began." Chase's gloom was mirrored by the distress of his daughter, whose marriage to William Sprague was in trouble. Kate had seemed to hold the balance of power throughout the courtship, yet William now believed he had a right to control his high-spirited wife. Though he had made her responsible for redecorating his several multi-million-dollar households, he angrily rebuked her in private and in public for exorbitant spending. "Can it be," she later lamented in her diary, "that he would keep this hateful thought of my dependence ever before me, forcing me to believe that every dollar given or expended upon his home is begrudged?" She worried that, reared in a pinched, prejudiced, narrow atmosphere, with the thought of the insatiable Moloch, money, always before him, he had invested in it all the power when, after all, it is only a tributary. "My father was, in comparison with my husband, a poor man, but he felt himself rich when he was enabled to bestow a benefit upon the needy or a pleasure upon those he loved, and a treasure laid up in his home was money well invested." Though she was proud of her new husband's worldly success as both a senator and businessman, she had hoped to be a partner in all his endeavors, as she had been with her father. She would gladly follow all his interests with sympathy and encouragement, she wrote, "but I cannot make them mine, for his effort would seem to be to show me that I have no part in them." In fact, he rebuffed her when she tried to talk of business or politics, complaining, in public, that she had different ideas and ways of life from his own. Most hurtful of all, Sprague had started drinking again. He would lash out at her when drunk, provoking bitter arguments that would take days to resolve. Kate could not restrain herself from replying to his insults with harsh and cruel words of her own. When sober, Sprague would vow reform, pledging to fill and occupy his place in the home circle he has created, as well as the position he has secured for himself in the world. These resolves were short-lived, and Kate began to fear that he did not seriously contemplate a worthy future, that his only thought was to slip through these obligations in life with the least effort possible. "God forgive me," she later confessed, "that I had so often wished that I had found in my husband a man of more intellectual resources, even with far less material wealth." Though she acknowledged occasionally loathing her husband, she also believed that few men were loved as much as she loved him. Perhaps she too was at fault. "My hopes were too high," she confessed, "proud, passionate, and intolerant. I had never learned to submit." Chase witnessed a fight between the young couple at Narragansett, but mistakenly interpreted the problem as a simple misunderstanding that time and patience would make right. His hopes seemed justified a few weeks later, when he learned that Kate was pregnant with her first child. The goodwill engendered among congressional radicals by Lincoln's appointment of Fessenden was swiftly eroded by his refusal to sign the punitive Reconstruction Bill that passed the Congress in the final hours of July 2, 1864, before it adjourned for the summer. Sponsored by Ben Wade and Henry Winter Davis, the bill laid down a rigid formula for bringing the seceded states back into the Union. The process differed in significant ways from the more lenient plan Lincoln had announced the previous December. Lincoln had proposed to rehabilitate individual states as quickly as possible, hoping their return would deflate Southern morale and thereby shorten the war. The Wade-Davis bill, in contrast, postponed any attempts at Reconstruction until all fighting had ceased. It required that a majority of a state's citizens, not simply 10%, take an oath of allegiance to the Constitution before the process could begin. In addition, suffrage would be denied to all those who had held civil or military office in the Confederacy and who could not prove they had borne arms involuntarily. Finally, the bill imposed emancipation by congressional fiat, where Lincoln believed that such a step overstepped constitutional authority and instead proposed a constitutional amendment to ensure that slavery could never return. Rather than veto the bill outright, Lincoln exercised a little-known provision called the pocket veto, according to which unsigned bills still on the president's desk when Congress adjourns do not become law. In a written proclamation, he explained that while he would not protest if any individual state adopted the plan outlined in the bill, he did not think it wise to require every state to adhere to a single inflexible system. Talking with Noah Brooks, he likened the Wade-Davis bill to the infamous bed designed by the tyrant Procrustes. If the captive was too short to fill the bedstead, he was stretched by main force until he was long enough, and if he was too long, he was chopped off to fit the bedstead. Lincoln understood that he would be politically damaged if the radicals chose to make a point upon this. Nevertheless, he told John Hay, "I must keep some consciousness of being somewhere near right. I must keep some standard of principle fixed within myself." He would rely on this conviction in the days ahead, when Wade and Davis published a bitter manifesto against him. He was not surprised by their anger at the suppression of their bill, but he was stung by their vitriolic tone and their suggestion that his veto had been prompted by crass electoral concerns. "To be wounded in the house of one's friends," he told Brooks, "is perhaps the most grievous affliction that can befall a man." The same sentiment he had expressed when he lost his first Senate race in 1855. Now, personal sorrow was compounded by the realization that radical opposition might divide the Republican Party, undoing the unity he had struggled to maintain through the turbulent years of his presidency. During the first week of July, rumors spread that a rebel force of undetermined strength was moving north through the Shenandoah Valley toward Washington. The rumors alarmed Elizabeth Blair, who feared that the Confederate troops would come through Silver Spring, Maryland, exposing both her parents' home and that of her brother Monty to direct danger. She cautioned her father, but his mind was elsewhere. For weeks he and Monty had been planning a hunting and fishing trip to the Pennsylvania mountains, and he was eager to get started. In a letter to Frank on July 4th, the 73-year-old Blair happily anticipated the 2-week vacation. Two grandsons were coming along. Their grandfather hoped to give them a taste for woodcraft and to amuse and invigorate them. Meanwhile, the womenfolk were heading to Cape May. "Your mother and I enjoy our young progeny's happiness as our own," Blair told his son, "and look on it as a prolongation of our enjoyment of the earth through a remote future." Elizabeth's admonitions concerned Monty at first, but after the War Department erroneously told him that the Confederate force had been stopped at Harper's Ferry, he and his father set off for the Pennsylvania countryside. Unable to prevent their departure, Elizabeth tried to convince her mother to remove the silver and other valuables to their city home before leaving for Cape May. Eliza Blair refused, telling her daughter she would not have the house pulled to pieces. Elizabeth Blair's fears proved justified. Grant's decision to move south of Richmond and attack Petersburg from the rear had inspired Lee to send General Jubal Early and 15,000 troops north, hoping to catch Washington unawares. If a panic like that which prevailed at the time of Bull Run could be induced, Grant might have to withdraw some of his troops from Virginia. For several weeks, Early's movements remained undetected, and on July 5th he crossed the Potomac into Maryland. At this point, only miscellaneous troops under the command of General Lew Wallace, later to become famous as the author of Ben-Hur, barred the path to the nation's capital. Wallace understood that with only half as many men as Early, he could not push the enemy back, but hoped he might hinder Early's progress while Washington prepared itself for attack. The two sides met at Monocacy River on July 9th. Young Will Seward, a colonel now, participated in the fierce engagement. "The battle lasted most of the day," he proudly recalled years later, "and every inch of the ground was hotly contested until our men were finally overwhelmed by superior numbers." During the fighting, Will's horse was shot from under him, hurling the young colonel to the ground and breaking his leg. Encircled by rebels when he fell, Will was assumed to have been captured. Secretary Seward spent a tense night at the War Department waiting for news of his son. He had just returned home after midnight when Stanton appeared with a discouraging report from General Wallace that Will had been wounded and taken prisoner. "None of us slept much the rest of the night," Fred Seward recalled, "and in the morning it was arranged that Augustus should go over in the first train to Baltimore to make inquiries." At 3 p.m., Augustus telegraphed more hopeful news. Though Will's injury was confirmed, he had not been captured. "God be praised for the safety of our boy," Francis exclaimed. With the help of one of his men, Will somehow reached a piece of woods, where, mounting a mule and using his pocket handkerchief for a bridle, he succeeded, after a painful ride of many miles during the night, in rejoining the forces. The routing of the Federals at Monocacy gave Early an unobstructed path to Washington. As the rebel troops ranged through the countryside, they destroyed railroad tracks, stores, mills, and houses, much as the Union men, under David Hunter, had done in Virginia. Reaching Silver Spring, they came upon Monty's Falkland mansion. Blair's carpenter reported that the troops had immediately commenced the work of wholesale destruction, battering the doors, robbing all the bookcases, breaking or carrying off all the chinaware, and ransacking the house from top to bottom. The next night, they torched the house, leaving only a blackened ruin. At the nearby home of Monty's father, the patriarch, the soldiers scattered papers, documents, and books. They rummaged through the wine cellar and the bedrooms, littering the lawn with furniture and clothing. Elizabeth Blair was told that one man dressed in Betty's riding habit, pants and all, another in father's red velvet wrapper. Still others donned assorted coats and uniforms, dancing with great frolic on the lawn. The perfect Saturnalia that Elizabeth decried was brought to an immediate halt when Generals Jubal Early and John Breckinridge arrived. Cursing the marauding soldiers, Breckinridge made them return stolen items. He retrieved the scattered papers and documents and sent them away for safekeeping. He asked Early to station a guard on the grounds to preserve the trees, grapery, shrubs, horses, and crops. When Early inquired why he would fret about one house when we have lost so much by this proceeding, Breckinridge replied that this place is the only one I felt was a home to me on this side of the mountains. He explained that some years earlier, during a difficult period in his life, the old gentleman had taken him in, providing a place of refuge and of rest. A neighbor told Blair Sr. that Breckinridge made more fuss about preserving the house and its possessions than if they had belonged to Jeff Davis. When the older Blairs eventually returned home, they found a note on the mantel. A Confederate officer, for himself and all his comrades, regrets exceedingly that damage and pilfering was committed in this house. Especially we regret that ladies' property has been disturbed. In this manner, Elizabeth marveled, bread cast upon the waters came back to us. The time the Confederates lost during the Battle of Monocacy and the frolic at Silver Spring allowed Washington to mobilize its defenses. In his initial panic, Stanton had sent his secretary to take his bonds and gold from a War Department safe and place them under his mattress at home. He took heart from Lincoln's calm demeanor, however, and thereafter the two worked together as one during the crisis. They telegraphed Grant, who put his highly respected Sixth Corps on a fast route to the Capitol. They called up the militia, supplied government clerks with muskets, and ordered all convalescents capable of defending the forts and rifle pits to report for duty. Throughout the tense days, Lincoln remained in a pleasant and confident humor, observed John Hay, not seeming to be in the least concerned about the safety of Washington. With him, the only concern seems to be whether we can bag or destroy this force in our front. Wells noted, approvingly, that Stanton exhibits none of the alarm and fright I have seen in him on former occasions. As nervous farmers with homes in the Confederate path poured into Washington, the President and the War Secretary drove together through the streets in an open carriage to show the people, one resident thought, that they were not frightened. Such calm, evinced by the administration, had a salutary effect, allowing the residents of Washington, who had despaired in the wake of Bull Run, a measure of solace. Some could even appreciate, as Fred Seward noted, the grim humor of their predicament in being thus suddenly attacked from the north after having sent their available troops to the south. By the time the Capitol dome was visible to the rebel force, the opportunity for a successful attack had receded. Before even the 1st Brigade of the leading division was brought into line, General Early later acknowledged, a cloud of dust from the direction of Washington revealed that Grant's reinforcements had arrived. Furthermore, inspection of the Union fortifications revealed them to be exceedingly strong, with a tier of lower works in front of each pierced for an immense number of guns. Stretching as far as the eye could reach, the earthworks appeared in many places to be impregnable. Still, Early refused to withdraw. He was determined to show the North how close he had come, and sent a small force to engage the Union troops at Fort Stevens, about 5 miles from the White House. The skirmishing continued for several days, during which time Lincoln witnessed the action from a parapet, accompanied by Mary on one occasion, by Seward and Wells on another. The tall President's presence in the line of fire made a vivid impression upon those who were there. The president evinced a remarkable coolness and disregard of danger, recalled General Horatio G. Wright. Even after a surgeon standing by his side was shot, he still maintained his ground till I told him I should have to remove him forcibly. The absurdity of the idea of sending off the president under guard seemed to amuse Lincoln, but in consideration of my earnestness in the matter, he agreed to compromise by sitting behind the parapet instead of standing upon it. Still, Lincoln would periodically stand, provoking concern on the part of a young captain who shouted, "Get down, you fool!" Years later, the captain, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., son of the poet whom Lincoln greatly admired, and himself to become a distinguished Supreme Court justice, would recall this unusual incident. For the normally sedentary Gideon Welles, to witness live action was exciting and wild, until the sight of dead soldiers carried away on stretchers instantly sobered his mind. In times gone by, I had passed over these roads, little anticipating scenes like this, and a few years hence, they will scarcely be believed to have occurred. Having made his point, Early retired as swiftly and mysteriously as he had come, leaving behind a spate of recriminations. The misguided command signals in Washington that allowed him to escape constituted an egregious blunder, acknowledged Stanton's aide, Charles Dana. Blame was generally attributed to General Halleck, though Welles knew that in the eyes of the public the entire administration appeared contemptible. Mary Lincoln, sensing her husband's profound disappointment that the rebels had escaped, turned on Stanton during a conversation at the soldiers' home. "Mrs. Lincoln," Stanton remarked with rare levity, "I intend to have a full-length portrait of you painted, standing on the ramparts at Fort Stevens, overlooking the fight." "That is very well," Mary replied. "And I can assure you of one thing, Mr. Secretary. If I had had a few ladies with me, the rebels would not have been permitted to get away as they did." Mary was not alone in her indignation. The sight of his ruined home provoked Monty Blair into openly defiant rants against the command structure in Washington directed by Halleck. His diatribes were reported to Halleck, who immediately wrote a furious letter to Stanton. "I am informed by an officer of rank," he began, "that the Honorable M. Blair, Postmaster General, in speaking of the burning of his house in Maryland, this morning said, in effect, that the officers in command about Washington are poltroons, that there were not more than 500 rebels on the Silver Spring Road, and we had 1,000,000 of men in arms, that it was a disgrace. On behalf of those officers who have devoted their time and energies night and day and have periled their lives, Halleck demanded to know whether such wholesale denouncement and accusation by a member of the cabinet receives the sanction and approbation of the President of the United States. If so, the names of the officers accused should be stricken from the rolls of the army. If not, it is due to the honor of the accused that the slanderer should be dismissed from the cabinet." Stanton sent the letter to Lincoln, who replied the same day, "Whether the remarks were really made, I do not know, nor do I suppose such knowledge is necessary to a correct response. If they were made, I do not approve them, and yet, under the circumstances, I would not dismiss a member of the cabinet thereof. I do not consider what may have been hastily said in a moment of vexation at so severe a loss is sufficient ground for so grave a step." Moreover, he concluded, "I propose continuing to be myself the judge as to when a member of the cabinet shall be dismissed." Then, to further underscore his authority in the matter, Lincoln composed a note to his cabinet colleagues, stating categorically that only he would decide when the time had come to let one of them go. It would greatly pain me to discover any of you endeavoring to procure another's removal, or in any way to prejudice him before the public. Such endeavor would be a wrong to me, and, much worse, a wrong to the country. My wish is that on this subject no remark be made, nor question asked, by any of you, here or elsewhere, now or hereafter. Lincoln's restrained reaction was validated by Blair's conduct once the shock of seeing his gutted homestead wore off. Learning that Ben Butler had torched a Confederate officer's house in retaliation for the burning of Falkland, Monty implored the general to avoid any more like actions. "If we allow the military to invade the rights of private property on any other grounds than those recognized by civilized warfare," he cautioned, "there will soon cease to be any security whatever for the rights of civilians on either side." When friends offered to raise funds for him to rebuild, he graciously declined their help. "The loss is a very great one to me, it is true, but it did not compare to the losses suffered by the unknown millions in this great struggle for the life of the nation. Could I consent to have my house rebuilt by friends, whilst my neighbor, a poor old blacksmith, is unrelieved?" Monty Blair had confirmed Lincoln's faith in him as a man and as a responsible public figure. The Postmaster General would retain his post until Lincoln himself decided it was time for him to go. "The month of August does not open cheerfully," Noah Brooks reported. "The steady progression of unfavorable events, the shocking slaughter at Petersburg, the raid on Washington, and the failure to capture Jubal Early's troops, had created a mood of widespread despondency throughout the North. In addition, the President's mid-July call for 500,000 additional volunteers had disturbed many Republicans who feared negative repercussions on the fall elections. Lincoln himself acknowledged the dissatisfaction with his new recruiting effort, but emphasized that the men were needed and must be had, and that should he fall in consequence, he would at least have the satisfaction of going down with the colors flying. Meanwhile, dispatches from Grant revealed a continuing stalemate in the siege against Petersburg. An ingenious attempt by a regiment of former coal miners to mine under the Confederate earthworks and blow a hole in the enemy lines had resulted in a spectacular tragedy instead. In the confusion after the explosion, Union soldiers advanced into the 32-foot-deep crater itself rather than circle around it, and had become trapped. Piled on top of each other like frightened sheep, they were easy targets for slaughter. By day's end, Grant had lost nearly 4,000 men. "It was the saddest affair I have witnessed in the war," Grant wired Halleck. "Such opportunity for carrying fortifications I have never seen, and do not expect again to have." The appalling event left Gideon Welles in a depressed state. Less, however, from the result, bad as it is, than from an awakening apprehension that Grant is not equal to the position assigned him. "A blight and sadness comes over me, like a dark shadow, when I dwell on the subject. A melancholy feeling of the past, a foreboding of the future." Edward Bates shared his colleague's despair. In his diary, he admitted feeling heartsick when he contemplated the obstinate errors and persistent blunders of certain of our generals. Unlike Welles or Bates, Lincoln refused to let the incident shake his faith in Grant. The day after the Battle of the Crater, he met with Grant at Fort Monroe, where the two men looked resolutely toward the future. Grant had received intelligence that the hard-riding Early had once again crossed the Potomac, spreading fear and devastation in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. He dispatched General Philip Sheridan, one of his best commanders, to the Shenandoah Valley, with instructions to find Early and follow him to the death. Wherever the enemy goes, let our troops go also. Lincoln, as determined as Grant to take the battle directly to the enemy without respite, replied, "This, I think, is exactly right." A few days later, Commissioner French enjoyed a long and very pleasant talk with Lincoln. He said we must be patient, all would come out right, that he did not expect Sherman to take Atlanta in a day, nor that Grant could walk right into Richmond, but that we should have them both in time. Lincoln's confidence was not now shared by the country. The ongoing disasters had combined to create much wretchedness and great humiliation in the land, a doleful Wells noted. "The people are wild for peace," Thurlow Weed cautioned Seward. Even before this train of events, Horace Greeley had taken it upon himself to counsel Lincoln. Greeley had received word that two ambassadors, representing Jefferson Davis, had come to Niagara Falls in Canada with full and complete powers for a peace. Urging the president to meet with them immediately, he reminded Lincoln that "our bleeding, bankrupt, almost dying country also longs for peace, shudders at the prospect of fresh conscriptions, of further wholesale devastations, and of new rivers of human blood, and a widespread conviction that the government is not anxious for peace and do not improve proffered opportunities to achieve it, is doing great harm." Though fairly certain that the so-called ambassadors had not been authorized by Jefferson Davis, Lincoln nonetheless discussed the matter with Seward and commissioned Horace Greeley to go to Niagara Falls. If the Confederate envoys were genuinely carrying legitimate propositions for peace, Greeley should offer them safe conduct and escort them to Washington. In addition, Lincoln dispatched John Hay to join Greeley at Niagara Falls and deliver a handwritten confidential note to the envoys. "To whom it may concern," the note read, "any proposition which embraces the restoration of peace, the integrity of the whole Union, and the abandonment of slavery, will be met by liberal terms on other substantial and collateral points." As Lincoln suspected, the two envoys had no credentials whatever and could offer no assurances that Jefferson Davis was ready to stop the war. He hoped the failed mission would demonstrate to Greeley and others the absurdity of the claims that he was the one preventing peace. Unfortunately, his intention backfired when the Confederate envoys sent Lincoln's confidential letter to the newspapers, falsely proclaiming that Lincoln's inadmissible demand for abolition had torpedoed the negotiations. Democratic newspapers embellished the story, accusing Lincoln of continuing the war for the sole purpose of freeing the slaves. Leading Republicans were also upset by the president's "to whom it may concern" letter. Looking simply for restoration of the Union, Thurlow Weed complained, "the people are told that the president will only listen to terms of peace on condition slavery be abandoned." Deeply disheartened, Weed and other leading Republicans became convinced that their party would be defeated in November. Weed journeyed to Washington during the first week in August and told Lincoln that his re-election was an impossibility. Leonard Swett felt compelled to inform his friend of a growing movement to call a convention and supplant him. A date for the new convention had been set for September 22nd, in Cincinnati, 3 weeks after the Democratic convention. Swett warned Lincoln that a most alarming depression had overtaken his erstwhile supporters, and that unless something were done to stem the tide, The situation was hopeless. Dissatisfaction was rife inside the cabinet as well. Both Gideon Welles and Montgomery Blair were mystified by Lincoln's decision to impose conditions that were inadmissible by their very nature. Knowing that only Seward and Fessenden had been privy to his plan, Welles questioned the president's right to assume this unfortunate attitude without consulting his cabinet. Henry Raymond, editor of the New York Times and chairman of the Republican National Party, added to Lincoln's woes, "I am in active correspondence with your staunchest friends in every state, and from them all I hear but one report," wrote Raymond in late August. "The tide is setting strongly against us." Raymond went on to predict that if the election were held immediately, Lincoln would be beaten in Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Indiana. Raymond ascribed two causes for this great reaction in public sentiment: the want of military successes, and the impression in some minds, the fear and suspicion in others, that the Confederates were ready for reunion and peace, but for the absolute demand that slavery be abandoned. He recognized the inaccuracy of this perception, but argued that it could only be expelled by some authoritative act, at once bold enough to fix attention. He recommended sending a commissioner to meet with Jefferson Davis to make distinct proffers of peace on the sole condition of acknowledging the supremacy of the Constitution, leaving all remaining issues to be settled later. Lincoln's response to these extraordinary pressures reveals much about his character. "I confess that I desire to be reelected," he told Thaddeus Stevens and Simon Cameron that August. "I have the common pride of humanity to wish my past 4 years' administration endorsed. And besides, I honestly believe that I can better serve the nation in its need and peril than any new man could possibly do. I want to finish this job of putting down the rebellion and restoring peace and prosperity to the country." Yet he forthrightly faced the likelihood of defeat and resolved to do his utmost in the remaining months both to win the war on the North's terms and to bring as many slaves as possible into Union lines before newly elected Democratic leaders could shut the door forever. In the third week of August, Lincoln asked all cabinet members to sign, without having read, a memorandum committing the administration to devote all its powers and energies to help bring the war to a successful conclusion. The presumption was that no Democrat would be able to resist the immense pressure for an immediate compromise peace. Slavery would thus be allowed to remain in the South, and even independence might be sanctioned. "This morning, as for some days past," the blind memo began, "it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterwards." In these same weeks, Colonel John Eaton recalled, Lincoln was considering every possible means by which the Negro could be secured in his freedom. He knew that Eaton had come into contact with thousands of slaves who had escaped as the Union troops advanced. Tens of thousands more remained in the South. Lincoln asked Eaton if he thought Frederick Douglass could be induced to come to see him and discuss how these slaves could be brought into freedom. Eaton was aware that Douglass had recently criticized the president vehemently, denouncing the administration's insufficient retaliatory measures against the Confederacy for its blatant refusal to treat captured black soldiers as prisoners of war. He also knew, however, that Douglass respected Lincoln and was certain that he would lend his hand. Douglas met with the president on August 19th. In an open conversation that Douglas later recounted, Lincoln candidly acknowledged his fear that the mad cry for peace might bring a premature end to the war, which would leave still in slavery all who had not come within our lines. He had thought the publication of his Emancipation Proclamation would stimulate an exodus from the South. But, he lamented, the slaves are not coming so rapidly and so numerously to us as I had hoped. Douglas suggested that the slaveholders knew how to keep such things from their slaves, and probably very few knew of his proclamation. Hearing this, Lincoln proposed that the federal government might underwrite an organized band of scouts composed of colored men, whose business should be somewhat after the original plan of John Brown, to go into the rebel states beyond the lines of our armies and carry the news of emancipation and urge the slaves to come within our boundaries. Douglas promised to confer with leaders in the black community on the possibility of such a plan. There was yet another subject Lincoln wanted to discuss with Douglas. 3 days earlier, Wisconsin's former governor, Alexander Randall, had hand-delivered a heartfelt letter from Charles Robinson, the editor of a Democratic paper in Wisconsin. "I am a war Democrat," Robinson began. "I have sustained your administration. It was alleged that because I and my friends sustained the emancipation measure, we had become abolitionized. We replied that we regarded the freeing of the Negroes as sound war policy, in that the depriving the South of its laborers weakened the strength of the rebellion. That was a good argument, and was accepted by a great many men who would have listened to no other. It was solid ground on which we could stand and still maintain our position as Democrats." Now, the Niagara Falls declaration that no steps can be taken towards peace from any quarter unless accompanied with an abandonment of slavery left him with no ground to stand upon. He was not writing for the purpose of finding fault, but with the hope that you may suggest some interpretation of it, as well as make it tenable ground on which we war Democrats may stand. Lincoln shared a draft of his reply with Douglas and requested his advice on whether or not to send it. "To me it seems plain," the draft began, "that saying reunion and abandonment of slavery would be considered if offered is not saying that nothing else or less would be considered." Having written these evasive words, however, he at once emphasized that as a matter of morals and a matter of policy, it would be ruinous to recant the promise of freedom contained in his proclamation, as it seems you would have me to do. For such a work, another would have to be found. Nonetheless, he acknowledged that if the rebels agreed to cease fighting and consent to reunion, so long as they could keep their slaves, he would be powerless to continue the war for the sole purpose of abolition. The people would not support such a war. Their congressional representatives would cut off supplies. All such figuring was irrelevant in any case, for no one who can control the rebel armies has made the offer supposed. Douglas saw clearly that Lincoln was trying to make manifest his want of power to do the thing which his enemies and pretended friends professed to be afraid he would do. Regardless of his personal convictions, he seemed to be saying, he could not carry on the war for the abolition of slavery. The country would not sustain such a war, and he could do nothing without the support of Congress. Douglas emphatically urged Lincoln not to send the letter. "It would be given a broader meaning than you intend to convey. It would be taken as a complete surrender of your anti-slavery policy and do you serious damage." After listening carefully to the impassioned advice of Douglas, Lincoln turned the conversation to other topics. While they were talking, a messenger informed Lincoln that the governor of Connecticut wished for an audience. "Tell Governor Buckingham to wait. I want to have a long talk with my friend Douglas," Lincoln instructed. Douglas could barely suppress his excitement when he encountered John Eaton later that day. "He treated me as a man. He did not let me feel for a moment that there was any difference in the color of our skins. The president is a most remarkable man. I am satisfied now that he is doing all that circumstances will permit him to do." Eaton believed that Douglas had seen the situation for the first time as it appeared to Mr. Lincoln's eyes. For his part, Lincoln told Eaton that, considering the conditions from which Douglas rose and the position to which he had attained, he was one of the most meritorious men in America. That same night, perhaps buoyed by his conversation with Douglas, Lincoln invited Governor Randall and Judge Joseph Mills to the Soldiers' Home for a further discussion of the Robinson letter. "The president was free and animated in conversation," Mills recorded in his diary. "I was astonished at his elasticity of spirits." Lincoln admitted from the outset that he could not help but feel that the weal or woe of this great nation will be decided in the approaching canvass. This was not personal vanity or ambition, but rather a firm belief that the Democrats' strategy of mollifying the South with a promise to renounce abolition as a condition for peace would result in the dismemberment of the Union. He pointed out that there were between 1,000 and 200,000 black men now in the service of the Union. If the promise of freedom were rescinded, these men would rightly give up their arms. "Abandon all the posts now possessed by black men, surrender all these advantages to the enemy, and we would be compelled to abandon the war in 3 weeks." Lincoln's tone grew more fervent as he continued, as if he were arguing with himself against sending the reply to Robinson. "There have been men who have proposed to me to return to slavery the black warriors of Port Hudson and Olustee to their masters to conciliate the South. I should be damned in time and in eternity for so doing." Those who accused him of carrying on this war for the sole purpose of abolition must understand that no human power can subdue this rebellion without using the emancipation lever. Let them prove by the history of this war that we can restore the Union without it. Mills, who had been initially skeptical of Lincoln, was overwhelmed by his transparent honesty and the depth of his convictions. "As I heard a vindication of his policy from his own lips, I could not but feel that his mind grew in stature like his body, and that I stood in the presence of the great guiding intellect of the age." His confidence in the justice of the Union cause could not but inspire me with confidence. The visitors stood to leave, but Lincoln entreated them to stay so that he might entertain them with a mix of stories, jokes, and reminiscences of the past. His momentary ambivalence over a peace compromise, put to rest by his own logic, Lincoln permanently shelved the draft of his letter to Robinson. Nor did he accede to Raymond's suggestion that he dispatch a commissioner to Richmond and sound out Jefferson Davis's conditions for peace. He played with the idea for a few days, even drafting a letter allowing Raymond to proceed to Richmond with authority to say that, "Upon the restoration of the Union and the national authority, the war shall cease at once. All remaining questions, including slavery, to be left for adjustment by peaceful modes." But he soon discarded the idea. The Raymond letter, like the reply to Robinson, was placed in an envelope and slept undisturbed for over 2 decades until unearthed by Nicolay and Hay when writing their biography of Lincoln. Through these difficult days that Nicolay deemed a sort of political bull run, Lincoln was sustained most of all by his ever-present and companionable Secretary of State. Mary and Tad had once again escaped the summer heat, spending August and early September in Manchester, Vermont. Seward had hoped to get away, but did not feel he should leave Lincoln in this trying period, when one difficulty no sooner passes away than another arises. His presence buoyed Lincoln, for he never lost faith that all would be well, while Seward agreed that the signs of discontent and faction are very numerous and very painful. He refused to panic, believing that any considerable success would cause them all to disappear. So long as ordinary people retained their faith in the cause, a faith evidenced by new enlistments in the army, Seward remained firm and hopeful, convinced that Lincoln would see the country through. Stanton provided additional reassurance to the beleaguered president. The relationship among Lincoln, Seward, and Stanton had strengthened over the years. Wells observed that the two S's had developed an understanding, enabling them to act in concert, supporting the president. Though Stanton lacked the genial temperament that won both Lincoln and Seward countless friends, he believed passionately in both the Union and the soldiers who were risking their lives to support it. Though he regularly argued with Lincoln over minor matters and peremptorily dismissed favor-seekers from his office, the sight of a disabled soldier would command his immediate attention. In the mind of this brilliant, irascible man, there could be no peace without submission by the South. On August 25th, Lincoln invited Raymond to the White House and explained why, after careful consideration, he had decided that sending a commissioner to Richmond would be utter ruination. Raymond was already in Washington, chairing a meeting of the Republican National Committee. The committee members, charged with organizing support for Lincoln in the upcoming election, had been so dubious about his chances that, as yet, they had done nothing to mobilize the party. John Nicolay believed the president's meeting with Raymond and his colleagues could prove the turning point in our crisis. As the group gathered that morning, Nicolay wrote to John Hay, who was visiting his family in Illinois, "If the president can infect R. and his committee with some of his own patience and pluck, we are saved." If the committee members were unmoved after talking with Lincoln, however, hope for the election would fade. Nicolay was relieved to see that Lincoln had invited Seward, Stanton, and Fessenden, the stronger half of the cabinet, to join the meeting. The results exceeded Nicolay's fondest hopes. In a memo written that same day, Nicolay delightedly noted that the president and his cabinet colleagues had managed to convince Raymond that to follow his plan of sending a commission to Richmond would be worse than losing the presidential contest. It would be ignominiously surrendering it in advance. Nicolay was convinced that the meeting had done great good. The president's iron will impressed the committee members. They returned home, encouraged and cheered, with renewed belief that the election could be salvaged. 2 days later, a revealing item appeared in Raymond's New York Times, noting that the members of the Republican National Committee would remain in Washington for another day to complete their plans for the presidential canvass. The Times declared, "Every member is deeply impressed with the belief that Mr. Lincoln will be re-elected, and regards the political situation as most hopeful and satisfactory for the Union Party." Even before the approaching military success in Atlanta, which would transform the public mood, Lincoln had alleviated his own discouragement by refocusing his intense commitment to the twin goals of union and freedom. He gave voice to these ideals in late August with an emotional address to the men of an Ohio regiment returning home to their families. I happen temporarily to occupy this big White House, he said. I am a living witness that any one of your children may look to come here, as my father's child has. It is in order that each of you may have, through this free government which we have enjoyed, an open field and a fair chance for your industry, enterprise, and intelligence, that you may all have equal privileges in the race of life, with all its desirable human aspirations. It is for this the struggle should be maintained, that we may not lose our birthright. The nation is worth fighting for, to secure such an inestimable jewel. The president's re-election campaign received a significant boost when the long-delayed Democratic convention finally met on August 29, 1864. Until this moment, when a candidate would be chosen and a platform written, Nicolay wrote, anxious Republicans had imagined giants in the airy and unsubstantial shadows of the opposition. Brooks, who had traveled to Chicago to cover the convention, agreed. He attributed the despondent mood that had overtaken Republicans in July and August to the fact that we have had nothing to solidify and compact us. A platform and candidate from here will materially change all this. Although Democrats had cheerfully capitalized all summer long on dissensions within the Republican camp, their own party was rent by the anger between war Democrats, who supported a continuation of the war until reunion, though not abolition, was assured, and peace Democrats, who called for an immediate armistice at any cost. They have a peace leg and a war leg, New York Herald editor James Gordon Bennett noted. But, like a stork by a frog pond, they are as yet undecided which to rest upon. When the convention opened, Noah Brooks reported, it seemed as if the peace Democrats had the upper hand. It was noticeable that peace men and measures and sentiments were applauded to the echo, while patriotic utterances, what few there were, received no response from the crowd. The playing of Dixie was cheered, while Union tunes were met with virtual silence. Though the peace wing commanded the emotions at the convention hall, it was generally assumed that war Democrat George McClellan would be the nominee. His partisans are united and have plenty of money, Brooks observed, while his opponents are divided as to their own choice. The peace wing, led by New York Governor Horatio Seymour, Congressman Fernando Wood, and former Congressman Clement Vallandigham, who had returned from his exile in Canada, floated several possible names, but with no consensus. As a result, when the balloting began, McClellan easily won. If McClellan's victory was expected, George Templeton Strong confided to his diary, the baseness of the platform on which he is to run was unexpected. Jefferson Davis might have drawn it. The word rebel does not occur in it. It contemplates surrender and abasement. Pressed upon the party by the peace contingent, the platform declared that, after 4 years of failure to restore the Union by the experiment of war, the time had come to demand that immediate efforts be made for a cessation of hostilities. Strong predicted that if McClellan agreed to represent this dishonorable platform, he condemns his name to infamy. Indeed, it was rumored that he would decline a nomination on such terms. For Democrats, the capitulation called for in their platform proved to be exceedingly ill-timed. 3 days later came the stunning news that Atlanta had fallen. Atlanta is ours, and fairly won, Sherman wired Washington on September 3rd. This joyous news, which followed on the heels of Admiral David Farragut's capture of Mobile Bay, Alabama, prompted Lincoln to order that 100 guns be fired in Washington and a dozen other cities to celebrate the victories. Jubilant headlines filled northern newspapers. "Atlanta is ours," the New York Times repeated. The foundries, furnaces, rolling mills, machine shops, laboratories, and railroad repair shops, the factories of cannon and small arms, of powder, cartridges, and percussion caps, of gun carriages, wagons, ambulances, harnesses, shoes, and clothing, which have been accumulated at Atlanta, are ours now. Although, unbeknownst to the Times, the departing Confederates had set fire to nearly everything of military value. Still, George Templeton Strong instantly understood the importance of Atlanta's fall. "Glorious news this morning," he exulted. "It is, coming at this political crisis, the greatest event of the war." Seward received the news from the War Department while seated in his library in Auburn, where he had finally escaped for a few days to see his family. He had barely finished reading Stanton's telegram before a crowd gathered at his house to celebrate. As the news spread, the crowd swelled until it spilled over to the park adjoining his residence. "Flags were hoisted in all parts of the city," a local correspondent reported. "All the bells commenced ringing, and a salvo of 100 guns was fired." At the request of the spirited assemblage, which included several hundred volunteers who were waiting to be mustered in, Seward delivered a spontaneous talk that lasted more than an hour. Seward's extemporaneous words were considered by one reporter present to be one of his most impressive and effective speeches. He remarked that the twin victories should help inspire the 300,000 more men, "volunteers, if you will, drafted men, if we must, necessary to end the war." He paid homage not only to the sailors and soldiers, but to the wisdom and the energy of the War Administration, pointing out that Farragut's fleet did not make itself, nor did he make it. It was prepared by the Secretary of the Navy. And he that shall record the history of this war impartially will write that since the days of Carnot, the military organizer of the French Revolution, no man has organized war with ability equal to that of Stanton. Seward ended with a moving tribute to his friend and president, telling the crowd that nothing was more important than Lincoln's re-election. "If we do this, the rebellion will perish and leave no root." The crowd roared its approval. When Gideon Welles read Seward's speech, with its generous praise for the Navy Department, he professed himself delighted. For a man of not very compact thought, often loose in the expression of his ideas, Seward had set forth an argument, Welles believed, that would serve as the keynote of the upcoming campaign. Welles understood that Atlanta's fall would wreak havoc on the plans of his old party, the Democrats. "This intelligence will not be gratifying to the zealous partisans who have just sent out a peace platform and declared the war a failure. There is a fatuity in nominating a general and warrior in time of war on a peace platform." McClellan, meanwhile, remained secluded at his home in Orange, New Jersey. He found himself under tremendous pressure from both factions of his divided party as he tried to draft his letter of acceptance. War Democrats warned that unless he repudiated the peace platform, his candidacy would be stillborn. Peace Democrats threatened that if he wavered on the proposed armistice, they might withdraw their support. He went through six drafts before he finally delivered his letter to the Democratic Nominating Committee at midnight on September 8th. He began with a nod to the peace wing. "Had the war been conducted for the sole purpose of preserving the Union," McClellan argued, "the work of reconciliation would have been easy, and we might have reaped the benefits of our many victories on land and sea." Were he in power, he would exhaust all the resources of statesmanship to yield peace. This said, he went on to disavow aspects of the strident demand for peace at any cost, insisting that hostilities would not end without the restoration of the Union. I could not look in the face of my gallant comrades of the Army and Navy, who have survived so many bloody battles, and tell them that their labors and the sacrifice of so many of our slain and wounded brethren had been in vain. The peace men were furious, but had no alternative candidate. The stage was set for the fall election. The fall of Atlanta produced a remarkable transformation in the mood of Republicans. "We are going to win the presidential election," Lincoln's longtime critic, Theodore Tilton, wrote Nicolay. "All divisions are going to be healed. I have never seen such a sudden lighting up of public mind as since the late victory at Atlanta. This great event, following the Chicago platform, a most villainous political manifesto known to American history, has secured a sudden unanimity for Mr. Lincoln." Even he, never having been a partisan for Mr. Lincoln's re-election, but the reverse, was intending to advise everyone he knew to unite on Mr. Lincoln. Leonard Swett, who only weeks before had warned Lincoln that his re-election looked doubtful, believed that God had given the Union its glorious victory to make the floundering ship of state right itself, as a ship in a storm does after a great wave has nearly capsized it. Relieved, Thurlow Weed informed Seward that with military success, the conspiracy against Mr. Lincoln collapsed. The changed public mood took Salmon Chase by surprise. He had spent the summer traveling through New England, meeting with abolitionist friends, including Ralph Waldo Emerson, Massachusetts Governor John Andrew, the writer Richard Henry Dana, Jr., and Congressman Samuel Hooper. He had maintained contact with organizers of the secret meetings being held to pursue the possibility of a new convention to draft an alternative to Lincoln. He had done his best, according to Gideon Wells, to weaken the president and impair confidence in him, expressing his discontent not in public speeches, but in social intercourse down east. Now that support for Lincoln had revived, Wells observed, Chase is beginning to realize that the issue is made up, and no new leaders are to be brought forward, and he will now support Lincoln. Deciding to return to Washington to offer his services to Lincoln, Chase stopped en route in New York. There he had an unsettling conversation with a gentleman who thought Lincoln very wise. If more radical, would have offended conservatives. If more conservative, the radicals. Would this, Chase asked himself, be the judgment of history? When he reached the Capitol, Chase called on Fessenden, who told him the president would like to see him. News of their meeting spread quickly. Mr. Chase had a long confab in his visit to the president yesterday, after abusing him everywhere at the North, Elizabeth Blair told her husband. 2 days later, Chase accompanied Stanton to the Soldiers' Home, where he once again spoke with Lincoln. I have seen the president twice since I have been here, Chase told Kate. Both times, third persons were present, and there was nothing like private conversation. His manner was evidently intended to be cordial, and so were his words. And I hear of nothing but goodwill from him. Graciousness did not satisfy Chase, however. He wanted the president to be more demonstrative toward him, after an absence of 2 months. Chase still acknowledged no responsibility for sundering their relationship, believing it was he who had been wronged and hurt by the events surrounding his resignation. I never desired anything else than his complete success, Chase insisted. and never indulged a personal feeling incompatible with absolute fidelity to his administration. Proud of his own magnanimity, Chase professed a conviction that the cause I love and the general public interests will be best promoted by his election, and I have resolved to join my efforts to those of almost the whole body of my friends in securing it. In the weeks that followed, Chase remained true to his word. He traveled by train, boat, and horseback to Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois, and Missouri, delivering dozens of speeches in support of Lincoln's re-election before overflowing crowds. Meanwhile, the state elections in Vermont and Maine revealed larger union majorities than the previous year. After the Vermont election, Nicolay wrote a cheery letter to Thurina. 3 weeks ago, our friends everywhere were despondent, almost to the point of giving up the contest in despair. Now they are hopeful, jubilant, hard at work, and confident of success. More good news greeted Republicans on September 19th, when Philip Sheridan, having finally caught up with Jubal Early in the Shenandoah Valley, fought a brutal but successful battle that destroyed more than a quarter of Early's army. The shouting of clerks could be heard in every government department when the news became known. "This will do much to encourage and stimulate all union-loving men," Wells recorded in his diary. Military success may have substantially cleared Lincoln's road to victory, but a serious obstacle remained in the form of John Fremont's candidacy. Time and again, a divided party had lost elections when a third-party candidate swayed the final result. To ensure party unity, Lincoln needed the support of the radicals. His task was made difficult by the dissatisfaction of men like Wade and Davis over his conciliatory policy on Reconstruction. In addition, the radicals objected to the continuing presence of Montgomery Blair in the cabinet, while Chase had been allowed to resign. Blair was aware that he had become the target of the radicals' wrath. When the Baltimore Convention passed its resolution, essentially calling for his dismissal, he had offered his resignation to Lincoln. Later that summer, his father had repeated Monty's offer during a visit with Lincoln at the soldiers' home. He assured Lincoln that to heal the party, Monty would very willingly be a martyr to the radical frenzy or jealousy that would feed on the Blairs, if that would help. At the time, Lincoln had declined to take action, saying that he did not think it good policy to sacrifice a true friend to a false one or an avowed enemy. But the pressure to remove Blair continued to build. Henry Wilson warned Lincoln in early September that tens of thousands of men will be lost to you or will give a reluctant vote on account of the Blairs. The feud between the Blairs and the radicals had rendered cabinet life increasingly unbearable. Monty Blair detested Stanton. He believed the war secretary was in league with Wade and Davis against both the Blair family and the president. He spoke publicly of Stanton with what John Hay considered unbecoming harshness, calling him a liar and a thief. When these intemperate words reached Stanton, he refused to sit in cabinet meetings if Blair was present. In mid-August, Wells observed that the two embittered colleagues had not interchanged words for weeks. Lincoln had no patience for such personal contention. He had warned his cabinet members in July to refrain from criticizing one another in public. He decided that when the opportunity arose, he would take Monty Blair up on his offer to resign. That moment arose when Michigan Senator Zachariah Chandler informed him that Blair's resignation would elicit the support of Wade and Davis for Lincoln's re-election. Chandler later asserted that the radical senator and congressman were only part of a larger bargain that included Fremont's agreement to withdraw his candidacy if Blair were removed. Historians have debated the extent of Chandler's influence on Fremont. By September, the Pathfinder had no hope of winning in any case, and realized that his reputation would be sullied if he stayed in the race. Two facts are clear. On September 22nd, Fremont announced his withdrawal from the race. Then, on the morning of September 23rd, Lincoln sent a letter to Monty's office asking for his resignation. "You have generously said to me more than once," he began, "that whenever your resignation could be a relief to me, it was at my disposal. The time has come. You very well know that this proceeds from no dissatisfaction of mine with you personally or officially. Your uniform kindness has been unsurpassed by that of any friend. Moreover, in the 3 years and a half during which you have administered the General Post Office, I remember no single complaint against you in connection therewith." Despite his offer to resign, Blair was surprised to find the dismissal letter on his desk. Later that morning, he encountered Wells and Bates coming out of the White House. "I suppose you are both aware that my head is decapitated," he told them. "I am no longer a member of the cabinet." Wells was so stunned that he asked Blair to repeat himself, at which point Blair took the letter from his pocket and read it aloud to his two colleagues. Blair said he had no doubt he was a peace offering to Fremont and his friends. Wells was uncertain, telling Blair that while pacifying the partisans of Fremont might have been brought into consideration, the president would never have yielded to that. Wells thought it more likely that Blair had been sacrificed to restore balance to the cabinet after Chase's resignation. Chase's partisans clearly felt wounded that their man was gone while his assailant remained. The removal of Blair would allow Lincoln to reconcile all parties and rid the administration of irritating bickerings. Lincoln chose the former governor of Ohio, William Dennison, to succeed Blair. Wells was saddened by Blair's departure. "In parting with Blair," Wells recorded in his diary, "the president parts with a true friend, and he leaves no adviser so able, sagacious. Honest, truthful, and sincere, he has been wise, discriminating, and correct." In the days that followed, Wells came to view the removal of Montgomery from our councils as the greatest misfortune that had befallen the cabinet. Bates was equally distressed. Though he did not consider himself so intimate with Blair, he respected his straight-speaking colleague and believed Lincoln had erred in making a bargain for Wade and Davis. "I think Mr. Lincoln could have been elected without them and in spite of them. In that event, the country might have been governed free from their malign influences." Although Blair was hurt by a dismissal that he felt was an unnecessary mortification, he remained certain, he told his wife, that Lincoln had acted from the best motives, and that it is for the best all around. His father wholeheartedly agreed. "In my opinion, it is all for the best," he told Frank, no doubt worried that his fiery son would make some regrettable public remark. The patriarch suggested that Monty himself had pressed this matter by intimating to Fremont's friends that he would resign if Fremont withdrew. In the end, the senior Blair concluded, "If it tends to give a greater certainty of the defeat of McClellan,